With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now, not ever.
I mean...
These comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
You know, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
Hello, and thanks for joining the ANU Canberra Times Meet the Author series, which is also destined to become an episode of Democracy Sausage Extra, ANU's very popular podcast series. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute here at the ANU, and I'm also part of the School of Politics and International Relations. Let me begin by acknowledging the country, the original custodians of the land on which we meet, the Ngunnawal people, and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. And for those of you who were ready for this event last week, I apologise for being unwell. I certainly did not wish to postpone it, but I was literally unable to do it. So I thank you for hanging around and joining us again this week. I can assure you that nobody was more disappointed than me, because I have very much been looking forward to meeting our guest this evening, author, sports writer, columnist, literary editor, triple Walkley Award winner, and all-round beacon of civilization, Malcolm Knox. Malcolm, welcome to the ANU, if only virtually, and to this combined Meet the Author / Democracy Sausage Extra event to discuss your latest offering, Truth is Trouble, The Strange Case of Israel Folau, or How Free Speech Became So Complicated.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks very much for having me, and I hope to remain a beacon for you for the next hour.
Now, I was captivated by this book, I might say, and I say that with sort of a pen to that, a bit of a confession, and that is that it was initially with a degree of trepidation that I sort of waded back into this issue. If I'm honest about it, I found it pretty tawdry as an issue at the time. I found it difficult to enjoy being engaged in. And I suspect there's a common reason for that between that feeling I had and the reason you felt you needed to write a book. And that is that it's full of kind of ambiguity, and it leaves many of us, particularly those of us with journalistic training, who are very much into the idea of free speech and freedom of expression. I mean, I guess everyone is, but journalists professionally are interested in that free flow of information, and yet also feel that there was some other, quite negative social forces involved in this. So it's not an easy issue to categorise. Am I right in saying that was one of the key reasons why you embarked upon this book?
Yeah, and when you say you were unable to enjoy engagement with it, I think that was a common feeling. That was certainly something I shared. What is an issue that we enjoy being engaged with? Well, probably something where we feel we have some clarity about the issues and where we stand in relation to them. And certainly to see if you're a believer in free speech as a broad principle, or if you feel that there is some kind of existing social consensus on it, to have those principles sort of turn back on you, as if, it's kind of the head of the snake eating its own tail. It's challenging, and when it comes to the particular issue of Israel Folau, which I'm sure we'll go into in more detail, it was also hard to you know, enjoy, if that's the right word, because for me, I was always put into a position where I was questioning what I felt previously. So the uncertainty around it was, you know, something, again, that really challenged me, and to be surrounded by people who had positions of great certainty was a challenge, but it also ultimately made it feel to me as if it was something worth unpacking further and further as time went by.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and I think you've done that admirably. But going to the point about uncertainty, it's not uncertainty is, I guess, by definition, not something we feel comfortable with, and we like to work through an issue. Sometimes, and some people rush to a conclusion very quickly. Other times we might work methodically through the pros and cons of an issue and we arrive somewhere. But this issue even denies us that to some extent, because of sort of cross currents, values on either side that that we might hold with some degree of preciousness, and yet feel that we don't stand fully on one side of the fence or the other. And as we all know, that's an uncomfortable place to be. Perhaps we could begin by just you giving a bit of an outline on the basics of the Falau case, just so that particularly because I'm thinking we have Democracy Sausage subscribers who reside overseas and perhaps will be less familiar when they're listening to this than perhaps the people we have watching tonight. So maybe if you could just give us a bit of a potted history of the Falau issue and then we'll take it from there.
Sure. I think the issue means nothing unless you put it against the context of the same-sex marriage plebiscite in Australia in 2017, which resulted in a vote in favour of reforming the law to enable same-sex marriage. Israel Folau was a rugby player who represented Australia. He was the highest profile player in that sport. He had a profile that he had gained from being a star player in rugby league. He had gone to the AFL where he drew a lot of publicity, and he then moved to rugby union. You know, two things. One is that rugby union was a sport and remains a sport that has extreme financial challenges and is probably more dependent on its corporate sponsors than the other major football codes. And Israel Folau himself was a Polynesian player who is important to Australian rugby in the sense that it is the code of choice for tens of thousands of young Polynesian sports people who the code needs to attract. So there was a kind of a dual financial dependence going on there. Israel Folau in 2018 responded to a social media post about same-sex marriage to condemn homosexuality. He was counselled by Rugby Australia at the time. Two parties emerged with different ideas of what had been the result of their counselling. Rugby Australia took the position that they had warned Folau that if he didn't, but again, he was putting his job at risk. Folau didn't come out of that meeting with the same understanding. A year later, in April 2019, Folau, he didn't quite repeat the initial transgression, which was a response in his own words, saying gay people would go to hell. This time he posted a meme that he had borrowed from the United States that listed a number of sinners, if you like, and said at the end of it, he said that they were destined to go to hell. And this was in response to a law changing in Tasmania that Folau had read about in April 2019 that allowed individuals to change their sex retrospectively if they had become transgender at a later point in life. Folau didn't approve of that, said he was quoting the Bible, and his defence when the predictable reaction occurred to his post. His defence was that he was quoting directly from the Bible, and he had never and could never unmake an undertaking to not quote God's word. The dispute between Israel Folau and Rugby Australia went on for some months in 2019. Seems like about 10,000 years ago now. But it ended in December that year with the union's decision to sack him, to strip him of his job, settled without going to court. Unfortunately, he received a settlement from Rugby Australia, and the matter, in as far as Israel Folau was concerned, ended there. However, it had dovetailed in the meantime with the, going back to the same-sex marriage debate, as you know, a quid pro quo, if you like, that Malcolm Turnbull initially threw out to the 30-odd percent of Australians who had voted against the same-sex marriage reform. The quid pro quo was the promise of a debate about a religious freedom bill that would take submissions from the public on the idea of privileging religious speech above other forms of speech. And to the extent that speech, if made in the name of religion, could be protected, if it vilified people under the existing anti-discrimination provisions of the law. One of the main lobby forces in that was the Australian Christian Lobby, an organisation representing a number of religious groups in Australia. They had become Israel Folau's main supporter, by which I mean the Australian Christian Lobby had raised more than $2 million for Israel Folau's defence and became his champion. So the bigger issue, if you like, which was the free speech debate in Australia, jumped onto the Folau bandwagon for a few months while it off service to the lobby. And then once the Folau issue itself was settled, the plan was for the Australian Christian Lobby and other supporters of such a religious freedom law would carry that forward into what they hoped would be a full-scale reform of our free speech laws this year.
Yeah, so that whole push for a for a religious freedom bill, which I must admit I was profoundly unconvinced by at the time, and I think I worked for the Sydney Morning Herald at the time, and wrote that it was a it was a solution desperately looking for a problem, because there didn't appear to be a problem. The Folau case was often cited. There were we can go into the sort of a number of the arguments that occurred there as to whether Folau was actually stopped from making his comments or not is a question in itself, of course, because no one was saying he couldn't make the comments. What the employer was saying, that Rugby Australia was saying, was that you can't make those comments as the face of Rugby Australia, effectively, and so there was that sort of employment dimension to it. But just to stick with the sort of big P politics of it for a moment, as you say, Malcolm Turnbull, the then Prime Minister, he's delivered same-sex marriage, a fairly tortured process in the end, something that had divided the governing Liberal coalition, mainly dominated Liberal Party, through that whole period. Malcolm Turnbull, a moderate and in favour of that marriage reform, eventually has delivered it by virtue of this plebiscite and then by legislation that upheld the outcome of that plebiscite largely. But he feels that he's got a major political problem on his hands. As you say, there's the sort of 30, whatever it was, 38% of the electorate that has voted against marriage reform. But probably more important for Malcolm Turnbull is that there's a rump within his party room who is particularly energised about this issue. So as Malcolm Turnbull tended to do a number of times, and I think to his own detriment in the end, he had a very, very close eye, weather eye, to the politics inside his party room, And so shortly after that plebiscite, even before they've legislated, he comes up with this proposal for a religious freedom bill for an inquiry initially, which would eventually result in at least a draft bill. So it's all tied up in that sort of conservative politics and these sort of biblical stuff and the Christian right, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and even after Scott Morrison replaced Malcolm Turnbull as Liberal Party leader and won the federal election, the Australian Christian lobby promoted its role as the kingmaker, if you like. It claimed credit for the amount of work it had done in marginal seats in what it called the miracle election. Now, how much of this was an organisation trying to blow its own trumpet and as opposed to how much was effective is almost a moot point because the Australian Christian lobby by late 2019 certainly saw itself as an inside voice in the Australian political process and in due to the debt it felt that that Scott Morrison owed it. And we know that Scott Morrison is a member of a Pentecostal church, which is loosely aligned with the Australian Christian lobby, but not tightly aligned. And on the Falau issue, in fact, the leader of Scott Morrison's church, Brian Houston, had come out as a voice against Falau. So it was the messages were even mixed up and the loyalties were mixed up within that group. It wasn't a monolithic Christian right juggernaut speaking with one voice.
Let's talk about the Christian lobby, the Australian Christian lobby, because there's a section in your book, in the early part of the book, where you talk about the day you spent at the Darling Harbour Convention Centre watching Israel Folau be paraded by Martin Isles, the chief managing director or whatever it is of the Australian Christian lobby, and Israel Folau is being paraded there as this this martyr really of this political correctness movement that's trying to shut down religious freedom and so forth. Take us through a little bit, paint the picture for us if you would of that day that you spent there and what struck you about it.
I went because it was the only opportunity I had to, hear Israel Folau speak in person. He was only doing at the end of the case or during the case. He only spoke to Alan Jones and Peter Credlin. That was the only media interview he gave. And the only face-to-face interview he gave was to Martin Isles as a means of promoting the Australian Christian Lobby's annual conference. It soon became apparent to me that Israel Folau was the sales banner out front, but the real story there was Martin Isles and his claims to being the person who'd done most to return the Morrison government to power. This is a guy in his early 30s, a young parishioner from the Brethren Church in Queensland, an extremely proficient, what you'd call a schoolboy or undergraduate debater. But he had also managed to earn the almost fawning loyalty of the elders of the Australian Christian Lobby, the chairman, the previous chairs, much older people than Martin Isles were proclaiming him almost, Christ-like status as, the young leader who's come forth to shine the way towards the promised land for us. And what you said before in your question about it being a way of appealing to people who felt besieged by the forces of political correctness was very much the theme of the day. It was very to understand what the ACL and the audience were against, and people who believe in climate change. The cultural statement was a statement from people who, oddly enough, felt as if they were a kind of a defeated and marginalised minority, which sat slightly uncomfortably with the idea that they had returned the coalition to power, but that didn't concern them so much. It was a rally for those who wanted to make that cultural statement. And, you know, what we've seen in the United States over the last 4 years is not without its parallels. Those of us who wonder how 70 plus million people could vote for Donald Trump even now might find an answer in the speculation that a lot of those millions of people are doing it as a cultural statement about what they don't like and what they would like to keep out of their world. And Martin Iles was using the same kind of language and the same kind of presentation to rally his folk.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
It's a fascinating moral kind of dilemma, though, for this constituency, isn't it? Because an objective observer, let's take Trump for a moment, and this is by no means a novel observation, but an objective observer would wonder how could the Christian lobby with its moral positions line up behind so shabby an individual as Donald Trump? So, someone with such a history of hedonism and misogyny and, you know, basically admitting sexual assault and being absolutely fast and loose with his business practices, with the truth, just freely lying. Essentially, really not in any way a model of Christianity as we would imagine Christians would see themselves. And yet, as you say, it becomes this cultural statement. Do you see any parallels between the ACL and those highly partisan Christian Pentecostal movements in the United States? Is the moral majority, Jerry Falwell's old thing, those kinds of organisations? It's highly political, isn't it?
Yeah, look, you don't need me to see the parallels. The ACL itself has been quite unembarrassed in borrowing the techniques and the language of the evangelical right in the USA. Does that, the next question it leads you to is, does that have any future in Australia? Is it, you know, do you think of that as more an American movement that is never going to quite sit right here because it feels such an import? And one of the, I guess one way of answering that is, you know, we eat as much McDonald's as anybody in the world and have been a colony of America for decades. But the other way of looking at it that I found more fruitful was to go to the history of Australian Protestantism, and it confused me at first, because the Protestant church that I had grown up in and was sort of used to was a church very firmly in the centre of our, as one of our institutions of conservative power. And by that I mean they existed and they had their place regardless of what party was, you know, in power in Canberra or elsewhere. When you looked at it, Australian history since colonisation, a little bit further back, you saw that the evangelical movement had been probably the most strong continual thread in Protestantism in Australia. And it went into something of an abeyance during the 20th century, but as religious belief overall went into decline in the late 20th century, the one exception to that was evangelicalism that grew its numbers and drew greater strength. And so if you look at the span of Protestantism, at least in Australia, over that 200-year period, you could say that the evangelicals have been the most constant thread, and that time in which they seemed like a bit of a, you know, the Bible bashing fringe group, that was the exception and the rule, which is re-emerging now. The rule is that those groups are going to be the most prominent voices. And I've got to say, the more religious belief declines, the stronger the political drive of those who remain becomes, and the stronger their attraction to religious people.
Yeah, it's interesting. On the day, you said you described this day and some of the people there and the atmosphere in this Darling Harbour Convention Centre, and you say that eventually, after a certain amount of fanfare, Martin Isles and Israel Folau, eventually share the stage, and the result of that interaction you describe as somewhat underwhelming. In fact, so much so that Martin Isles realises that Izzy's perhaps too dull and interrupts to declare, "Izzy Folau is to be admired because he makes complicated things so simple. Israel is in a fiery trial because he did not bow to the gods of Babylon, and their names are L, G, B, T and Q." So it's pretty clear where it was going, what the opinion of the organisation was, and indeed the level of energy that Martin Isles was bringing, that it was really, I mean, Folau might have been the draw card, but the show was really about Martin Isles and the ACL, the Australian Christian Lobby.
Yeah, and this was the plan leading to the religious freedom bills that we talked about before. The ACL was a, extremely prominent those bills, which up to the pandemic crisis, I don't know if they were going to continue their passage towards becoming law. There were many more people who made submissions to that inquiry who were opposed to it, and many more who took the view that you you voiced earlier about the problem wasn't there, it was being created by the process, but the process was all about making those people, such as the ACL, feel as if they were heard. And of course they didn't want to be just fobbed off as given their little 5 minutes and told to go away. They believed and still believe that once things settle down, they can still drive this through to the status of a law that privileges religious speech.
So you think it's still alive?
I don't think it's still alive. I can't imagine that it would be still alive. But certainly the ACL thinks it's still alive. And what's been really interesting about the last 9 months is that from March through April, and that was during the time I was writing the book, I really thought, well, you know, one of the silver linings of the pandemic will be that these silly marginal arguments people have been having are going to be put into perspective and taken not only off the back burner but off the stove completely. As we went from that period of initial crisis reaction and the uncertainty about how fast and how far it was going to go in Australia, the debate on religious freedom didn't really, you know, get its temperature anywhere near back to where it was in 2019, but it managed to attach itself to all of the other culture war causes that were reviving themselves and had the remarkable ability to conscript the pandemic itself into the cause.
Yeah.
So we've seen, and, you know, we're talking about parallels with America, we've seen how probably between about June and July was the kind of turning point where the sense of crisis abated somewhat and the response to the pandemic was politicised, and, you know, the wearing of a mask was seen as a political statement. Now we have the wearing of the masks with Australian flag and similar elsewhere in the world. It's remarkable just to see the power of this movement to grab a whole lot of unrelated issues and bring them under the same roof that still motivates the followers in the way that religious freedom had prior to the pandemic.
It's almost politicked by Venn diagram, isn't it, where you just sort of work out what are these other issues that this constituency is by and large likely to hold dear, and we'll sort of pull them all in together and package them up, you know, for the cumulative sort of grievance value that you might be able to give them and spout them back at people.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you might wonder, as I wanted, you know, how is climate change part of this culture war debate, and how is the pandemic part of it? But
They find a way,
and you know, it's guilt by association, if you like, that that progressive politics is seen as aligned with both belief in climate change and doing something about climate change, and reforming marriage laws, which is the main driver for the religious right. So they become visible in the eyes of that movement.
I was going to go to intersectionality, and we'll do that in just a sec. But just on the last point you made about, you know, the marriage laws, it struck me at the time, I was very closely involved in reporting this, you know, through that period, that there was a lot of heat about whether there would be a free vote in the parliament, or whether there would be a national plebiscite. In the end, there was that kind of thing run by the Bureau of Statistics, a statistical survey, supposedly. But for all the opposition to it on the progressive side of the spectrum, with people quite rightly arguing that the parliament was put there to do the job and ought to legislate it, in the end, through that messy process, there was a very decisive public vote with a very high turnout, as you put you point out in the book, a very high turnout of Australian voters, and there's a very decisive result, you know, 62% thereabouts in favour of marriage equality. That must have been a real thumb in the eye to the Christian lobby, because in a sense it made the change far more durable. It was no longer something you could just roll back, get your side back into politics, into government, if you don't regard them as there now, and, you know, and legislate to take the marriage definition back to what it was. That's virtually impossible once you've gone through that plebiscite process. Do you think Turnbull was clever in that respect?
I don't know, but politically, when you talk to these people and when you hear these people, losing a debate and losing it decisively is almost better for them than winning it, because the identification of themselves with underdog
victimhood
is really important, and that's something that you know, if you've lived through several decades, you're almost in shock to see the tools of victimhood being appropriated by a group of people who, in many ways, traditionally very much not the victims and not the outsiders in Australian society. But, you know, going back to the Howard's Battlers period, this has been an effective tool of the political right, and, you know, points to the division within the Labor side of politics, that they, you know, are wedged on the different parts of their constituency. So on the matter of the same-sex marriage debate, I actually asked my own son, who is a Christian, and he belongs to the Sydney Anglican Church, who've been, you know, quite out there at the more politically active edge of these culture war-driven politics, for instance, making a large donation to the No case in the same-sex marriage debate, and having a very, very forceful anti-same-sex marriage view even after legalisation. And I asked him, I said, you know, how is it that you belong to this church, which is, you know, it's the oldest, biggest, most beautiful church in the heart of Sydney, which with, you know, the Archbishop of the Anglican Church as your head, what could be more establishment than that? And his response, you know, fairly quietly, was those people that he goes to church with, they feel that they're the losers. They feel that they've lost all the big arguments that they care about, and they have to fight this rearguard action. And so losing the same-sex marriage vote so comprehensively only entrenched that energy.
Well, I mean, that's a very interesting point. I accept that it may have entrenched the energy, but I also think it's made it pretty much impossible to roll it back, because it, for all the criticism that the process attracted, and I understand why that criticism was there, and I shared some of it at the time, but I think in the end, I think it becomes more durable by virtue of the fact that you can't gainsay a free question put to the public, and when you know, 6 in 10 vote one way, that's the way our system works. But it's not just a problem, of course, I'm speaking now more about the issue from which same-sex morphed into, and that is this debate around Israel Folau, the particular subject of your book. Not just a problem for the right, is it? And that's why you mentioned at one point in the book this sort of challenge of intersectionality, where some of the interests, some of the values of the left cut across each other in the debate about Israel Folau. For example, his ethnicity. For example, the role of Christianity as a colonial tool right through the Pacific, which has led to many people from his part of the world holding these very strong religious views of a particular kind. So, and then of course there's the whole question of, you know, cancel culture and where the left stands on freedom of expression. So this is, and this goes right back, I guess, to where we started this discussion. This is why this issue is so difficult, I guess, because there are so many different currents and they're overlapping each other.
Yeah. So if you are a person with what you think of as progressive politics, if you could simplify the Folau thing to an utterance of homophobia that disgusted you, and you could keep it inside that box, it would be a simple matter for you. But as you allude to, you know, the questions of colonisation and the Protestantism that colonised the Pacific Islands, that fostered the religious adherence that now comes into Australia and sort of bounces back at the colonisers, is a really interesting take on it. Similarly, the labour lawyers, or if you would say lawyers who have defended the rights of employees against employers, can make a very persuasive argument, not only from the Folau case but from others where employees have lost their jobs for social media performances. These lawyers have argued that this is way out of line, and we're seeing a strengthening of employers' power over employees' private time and their freedoms.
Can I interrupt you there, Malcolm? The two cases which many people will know about will be this Folau case and the Scott McIntyre case from SBS back in, what was it, 2015, yeah. Was it? 2015, because it was the centenary of Gallipoli. And that's when he made a series of tweets. This SBS sports employee made a series of tweets in relation to Gallipoli, which were, fairly harsh, and SBS ended up sacking him. So there's a couple of really high-profile cases. But as you say, a great example of intersectionality in a way, because you've got people broadly of the left who would see themselves as interested in protecting employee rights, but at the same time they would also be offended by homophobia, by the agenda of the Christian right and so forth. So it's highly complicated.
It's not so much hard to know where you stand as hard to deal with the fact that you stand on both sides simultaneously of numerous fault lines.
Do you think the two cases are as similar as some people would have? I would argue, for example, that Folau is paid a vast sum of money, way above community standards for the job that he does. And that he is the public face of an organisation, one of the key public faces. There is this issue about his rights versus the rights of what you might call big money. Corporate Australia, Qantas and others who have investments in Rugby Australia as far as advertising goes, Rugby Australia itself. But at the same time, you've got Folau, who's no minnow in this process. He's in multi-million dollar salaries and the like, and none of that would be there were it not for all of that big money that is associated with him having a public profile. So even that's not easy to dissect.
That's right, and the architecture of those two cases is completely different, because in Scott McIntyre's case, it was SBS, his employer, who felt the repercussions for it, or potential repercussions, and SBS acted, if you like, on its own account. Whereas in Folau's case, Rugby Australia admitted that it was acting as a proxy for its main sponsor, Qantas, and other sponsors. And the chairman of Rugby Australia at the time, Cameron Klein, sort of said, we're not really taking a moral position on this, but if we kept on, we lose all of us, Qantas, we're going to walk out, and Range Rover, we're going to walk out. And so it was kind of a business decision.
Yeah, pretty understandable. And that Bill Pulver, the CEO, had already aligned Rugby Australia with the same, in favour of the Yes case and the same-sex marriage plebiscite. So this was a long-term irritant of Folau's, wasn't it?
And continues to be so, by the way, because many of the rugby players at the top level in Australia sympathise with Folau's views and held the same views. They were not as vocal in pressing the views, but they it hasn't gone away just because Israel Folau has gone away.
And Rugby Australia had, as you point out in the book also, it was the sort of the poor cousin of the two other major codes, the major impact codes anyway, if we leave round ball football out of it, in the AFL and Rugby League. Rugby Australia was trying to rebuild its brand, was trying to step forward, and it had inclusiveness as one of its key values. So Folau's comments are completely at odds with that level of inclusiveness by devaluing a whole class of people in society. So I don't have any trouble understanding why, as an organisation, it would say this is contrary to the image we are trying to put forward. And similarly with those sponsors, companies like Qantas, who had also been very strongly in support of the Yes case. So you can see that argument there. The question was, did the contract reflect, had he ceded any ability to make public comments on these things, either by way of his contract or by way of undertakings given in, for example, that first counselling session he had with management?
A lot of us, not just journalists, a lot of us were really disappointed that it didn't go to court, because each of these cases, and there's a growing number in Australia where employees have lost their jobs, that they get settled or one way or another they end before they proceed to the higher legal tribunals, which at least through case law could provide some clarity to these questions, but we're still waiting for that one.
Look, we're very close to time. There's just one question here that I'm going to try and read to you from someone called Mark Laurie. I've not had a chance to read this book yet. I'm wondering to what extent you or your book draw back to the influence of the European missionary effect on Polynesia and Israel Folau as a product of it. We've sort of touched upon that a bit already, but if you want to just very quickly make an observation in response to that.
Look, it's really important when it comes to the question of leadership, and within rugby we have ever-growing numbers of Polynesian players who are not given leadership positions. Their way of expressing leadership is quite different from the existing ways that the rugby community accepts. And you could say that Israel Folau was trying to take a leadership role in a particularly Polynesian way. And I think one thing that could be learned, leaving aside the sort of strange religious views that Israel Folau might hold, institutions like sporting institutions need to broaden their ideas of what leadership means and how leadership is expressed. And it won't do just to keep considering Polynesian players as the colonised.
Yes, thank you very much. That's a very interesting point. Look, Malcolm Knox, thanks for joining us for this special Meet the Author Democracy Sausage session. And good luck with Truth is Trouble, The Strange Case of Israel Folau. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I know we've had some technical difficulties, so I apologise profusely. Of course, they're beyond our ability to handle as they come up. And I'm sure that many people understand that in this COVID-ravaged year, things are being done a bit differently, and these technical problems are unfortunately a bit of a fact of life. And I hope that you'll give us some leeway for that. As I say, Malcolm, thanks so much for joining us, and good luck with the book. And thank you, everyone, for sticking with us on this special Meet the Author series. I'm Mark Kenny. Bye for now.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.